This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the Dominican Republic's racist policies against Haitians becomes part of the congressional race in Harlem. The chairman of the Black is Back Coalition says Barack Obama has been worse for black people than George Bush. And U.S. policy pushes Russia and China into a closer political and economic alliance.
But first, the last conventional public school closed in the New Orleans Recovery School District last month, making New Orleans the first nearly all-charter school district in the United States. Parents groups have filed suit against the district and the Louisiana Board of Education, charging that politicians and businessmen use the Katrina crisis to methodically kill off public schools and fire teachers. Karen Harper Royal is a parent advocate and member of the Coalition for Community Schools. She says the charter school takeover in New Orleans may signal the end of public education as we have known it in the United States.
The Recovery School District is being promoted as a model of how to transform public schools in mostly urban centers. So apparently this model means taking it out of the public realm and putting it into the hands of private, nonprofit boards, sometimes for-profit corporations. That's what it's signaling if New Orleans is a model.
Yes, and what has that transformation wrought on the ground in terms of students and, first of all, their access to schools?
Well, in the complaint we filed, we had concerns that as the Recovery School District closes schools, that the access that they had to higher performing schools consisted mostly of C, D, and F rated schools, which in Louisiana are really considered failing schools, because if you attend a C, D, and F rated school, you could apply for a voucher to go to a private school. And we have concerns that our kids are not getting access to the A and B rated schools in the same proportions that they appear in the population. It seems that white kids are disproportionately taking up the seats in the A and B rated schools. The example is at my own son's school. Black kids make up 80% of the school-age population in New Orleans. But at my son's school, which is a charter school because I kind of have no choice but a charter school, black kids are only 30% of the population. That is one of the highest rated schools in the city, but black kids are only there at 30%. That's a problem. We have a couple of other schools. Those are the only two schools in the city that give some neighborhood preference. Well, those are white neighborhoods. So where you have these two A-rated schools that have a neighborhood component, we don't have an A or a B or any other school in the city in black neighborhoods that give neighborhood preference. That's another one of the areas of concern in our complaint.
So what we see is a kind of tracking system.
I think what it does is resegregate. All these years, and we're back in a segregated school system for many kids, and also now it's also along class lines because, of course, the black kids who do get into these higher performance schools end up being in higher percentages, more middle-class black kids. So the poor kids who are trapped in the recovery school district end up having their choices of C, D, and F schools in large number. I mean, even the recovery school district admits that a lot of the kids who left these schools that they're closing ended up in C-rated schools or lower.
So those studies that show that charter schools lead to higher rates of segregation, those things are borne out in New Orleans.
I think it is absolutely playing itself out in New Orleans. Louisiana has a system where there's six different types of charter schools. And one of the types of charter schools is called a Type 2. It's a charter that's chartered straight from the State Board of Education. The locals don't have anything to do with it. And we see here in New Orleans, as some of those Type 2 charter schools are created, they're set up in a way that they end up having very large percentages of white kids That might be like a language immersion charter that has as a prerequisite that you already have some exposure to a foreign language. So that is a way that they kind of set their population up, where it's going to be mostly white or mostly middle class and above parents choosing that school. And so what I'm seeing with charters in New Orleans is that it's kind of set up a more stratified school district, or tracking, as you say. So you kind of have certain schools for people at a certain level who mostly end up being black kids. And then if you're a white kid in New Orleans, you're going to end up at this handful of schools, six or seven schools, that don't have the same kinds of archaic discipline policies you find in the recovery school district charter schools. These charter schools, a lot of them, have this no excuses model, and it's more militaristic. And you're able to see this kind of early pipeline to prison effect going on at some of the recovery school district charters, whereas you go to these schools that have any more than 10% white kids in them, you don't see children having to stand in line and go through metal detectors and have their backpack searched. We actually saw that at an elementary school, and then I know it happens at several of our elementary schools in the recovery school district because I've seen it with my own eyes. But recently we kind of took a tour of the schools that are closing, and one of the schools, it's a K-8 school, we were wondering why these children were standing in line to enter the cafeteria, and we looked a little closer. Here you got kindergarten kids, first grade kids standing in line, going through a metal detector, and their backpacks being searched. We had just left my son's school, where you see kids walking in with their coffee cup, you know, their earbuds in their ear. And the differences at a school where there's a large white population compared to the school where these kids are, it was heartbreaking. It was very painful to watch, even though I know it goes on here because I've seen it over the last 23 years. It was still very painful to watch. And so this school is a school that's closing, and the kids who are leaving this school, most of them will be going to C and below-rated schools. They're not going to get access to this A or B-rated charter school where the kids have a little more freedom.
But they can get access to a voucher and feed into a private school system.
That is true. They can get access to a voucher. Transforming a public school system, New Orleans style, means really getting rid of public education.
Now, you wrote your complaints to the superintendent of education for the state, John White, and he essentially called it a joke, the equivalent of laughing in your face.
Yes, and that's really a very irresponsible and dismissive posture for him to take. You would think that a superintendent of education would take very seriously any claims of discrimination in a school district in his jurisdiction. That is just unconscionable, and that is why we're calling for his resignation, because it is his responsibility to ensure that there isn't any discrimination going on. And for someone who is at the helm of pushing education reforms in our state to dismiss credible civil rights concerns is very disturbing.
Clearly, you're not going to get any redress from that quarter, so you filed a civil rights complaint with the U.S. Justice Department.
Yes, and the Department of Education Office for Civil Rights, because if this man's going to call our complaint a joke, we certainly can't depend on him to really investigate these very credible concerns. So we have filed our complaint, and we're waiting to hear from the Justice Department and the Office for Civil Rights.
And how are black teachers faring in New Orleans?
After Hurricane Katrina and the state took over the vast majority of our schools, the elected school board ended up having to fire those teachers because they no longer had schools. However, the recovery school district, which was coming into play to take those schools, had a responsibility to at least offer those jobs to those teachers, and they did not. And because of that, there is a $1.1 billion judgment against the Orleans Parish School Board and in some part against the state for not offering those jobs to those teachers. And so as schools are closed, and now that we're, you know, fast forward past Katrina, the Recovery School District came into being and it ran its schools into the ground and closed them. As those schools are being closed, teachers are losing their jobs again, because what will open up in the spaces where those schools are closed are charter schools, and many of the charter schools that are opening up in these spaces have large amounts of Teach for America teachers among their teaching corps, and lots of them are white.
So the children lose their neighborhood schools. They are largely consigned to the lower rated schools, and the community loses all those black teachers who lived in New Orleans and were anchors of the community.
Let me just make one clarification. We lost our neighborhood schools when the state took over our schools after Katrina. In New Orleans, we were busing children to schools all across the city. You didn't have a right to a neighborhood school after Hurricane Katrina. So the schools that these kids have now come to love, and the people and the teachers in these schools that they have built relationships with, they now have to lose that and go find new schools to go to.
So they're inflicting a second wave of trauma on the kids.
Absolutely. I know how I felt. I needed continuity. My son was in fifth grade after Hurricane Katrina. And when we brought him back, we made a point of getting him right back into the same school he was at before. That was not possible for most children in this city. But I knew how important it was. And any educator will tell you that when you change schools, especially in those early years, there's a certain amount of learning loss that takes place. So if we know this is a problem for children who were, number one, traumatized by the hurricane, number two, traumatized by now having to go to new schools, now we're going to traumatize those same children again by taking away that school from them and make them go assimilate into a totally new environment simply because we want to put different kids in that building so that we can say that that building is no longer a failing building. That's how you transform schools in New Orleans. You take the children who may be low performing out, and you scatter them to the wind, and then you bring in a whole new group of kids in the building, because that's what's going to happen with all but one of these schools. New children will be put into that building from other charter schools that are operating already.
So essentially, they're just creating spaces for more charter enterprises.
That's exactly what's going on. The Recovery School District could have ran its schools in a way that they're successful. And I just want to make sure that you knew this, because a lot of times people are getting this wrong as they talk about New Orleans go all charter. It is only the Recovery School District that's all charter. The elected school board still operates, I say, 5/6 schools, because it's really 6 schools, but one of those schools are on the same campus of another. And that elected school board, over the last 9 years, has operated those direct run, open enrollment, traditional schools, kind of at a level of a B on average. Anybody could apply to go to these schools. Anybody can apply to go to the Recovery School District schools. The Recovery School District schools have operated on a level of an F over the 9 years. So it really begs the question, did the Recovery School District run those schools into the ground so that they can create those spaces for charter schools, so that they can say that those schools are failing? You have to ask that question, because we're looking at the same population in the same city. Nobody, the Recovery School District nor the elected school board, have neighborhood schools. Every child in New Orleans must apply to go somewhere. And so if we're pulling from the same pool of children, how is it that consistently over the last 9 years, the elected school board's open enrollment traditional schools operated around a B, and the Recovery School District open enrollment traditional schools operated around an F, such that they would close them because they're failing and put new charters in the building? Don't you think that's interesting?
One would draw the conclusion that either all the competent people are in the elected schools or that the recovery schools are being mismanaged on purpose.
But the recovery schools are the reform, and the reform is being called a success in New Orleans. Haven't you heard? You know, sometimes people compare the wrong things. So they want to compare what the schools were like before Katrina to what the schools are like post-Katrina, which you really can't compare that when over 100,000 poor people did not return to New Orleans. So that alone will skew the numbers in your public school system. But that's not what you should be comparing. let's look at how the Recovery School District has performed in the 9 years after Katrina compared to the elected school system and their direct run open enrollment school, because they do have some selective admissions charter schools, which are a problem. But let's look at their open enrollment schools. Let's compare apples to apples. And when you put the apples to apples comparison on the table, the Recovery School District is a failure. And, well, they can't be incompetent. And, you know, it was the elected school board that was incompetent. That's why the state took the schools from the elected school board in 2005, supposedly. So the Recovery School District is the reform. They know better, supposedly, how to operate our schools. And if they do have the solution, why did not they invoke that solution on their direct operated open enrollment traditional schools? If they have the solution, but it seems that their solution is only to charter schools.
That was Karen Harper Royal of the Coalition for Community Schools in New Orleans.
The Dominican Republic has long abused and discriminated against people from Haiti, its neighbor on the island of Hispaniola. Last September, the Dominican legislature passed a law to deny citizenship to Dominicans of Haitian descent, even if they and their parents and even grandparents were born in the Dominican Republic. The law is viewed as racist throughout the Caribbean, and the controversy has now become part of the race for Congress in New York's Harlem. Demonstrators gathered outside a televised debate between incumbent black congressman Charles Rangel and challengers Adriano Espaillat and Reverend Michael Walrond. Haitian community activist Dahoud Andre explains.
The two main candidates, Congressman Rangel and State Senator Adriano Espaillat, both of them have come out on record in support of what we call the apartheid policy of the government of the Dominican Republic. For generations, it's a situation of apartheid, we call it, that Dominicans of Haitian descent living in the Dominican Republic have lived through and are still living through. The Dominicans of Haitian descent, for many years, as a matter of having been born there, some of them, not all of them, had been recognized by the government of the Dominican Republic as Dominican citizens. And since 2005, really, it's been a gradual process of disenfranchisement. In this climaxed in September of 2013, when the highest court in the Dominican Republic made a ruling that said that any person who was born in the country of parents who were not documented, meaning either having a residency or being a citizen of the Dominican Republic, from 1929 to 2007, automatically, from that day of the ruling, their citizenship was annulled. This created an uproar inside the Dominican Republic and throughout the world, from not just people in the Haitian community who have traditionally fought against the treatment of Haitians in the Batays, in practically slave-like conditions, the treatment of Haitian migrant workers who are recruited in Dominican businesses, send what are called buscones, recruiters, to Haiti, to the poorest places in Haiti, to recruit workers to come and work in different industries in the Dominican Republic. And then these people, when it's time to pay them, they call in immigration, and you have these mass deportations. We've always fought against this. But with this ruling, many different forces galvanized, and it was a world outcry, which came to a call for a boycott against tourism in particular, but Dominican products and services. So the world was asking for a reversal, the people of conscience around the world, I should say, because the United States, for example, which is called the leader of the free world, we laugh at this, did not call for a reversal of this unjust decision.
And either did Congressman Charles Rangel.
Well, absolutely not. So 3 weeks ago, a law was passed in the Dominican Republic. This is a law the Dominican President Danilo Medina proposed, which basically said that of the 210,000 Dominicans of Haitian descent that they recognize in the Dominican Republic, the number is much more, but this is what they say they recognize, 13,000 will get their citizenship restored from that ruling. So we said, well, this is a farce. How can you say that a problem affects 210,000 people and then you pretend to give relief to 13,000, less than 10% of that affected population? Most of them, their parents are from Haiti, but have lived in the Dominican Republic for 40, 50 years without ever having gone back to Haiti. And the Dominicans of Haitian descent we're talking about, they do not speak Creole, the language of Haiti. Many of them have never stepped foot on Haitian soil. So why we protested that both Congressman Rangel and State Senator Espaillat, they have praised this law as a humanitarian measure, as a measure of justice. And Senator Espaillat has gone so far as to, he went to the Dominican Republic for photo op with the Dominican president, and he actually called for this law to be replicated around the world in countries with a difficult immigration problem. So we say, what would the Dominicans here in New York say if the United States government would come out with a law like this to say whoever came to the U.S. without papers, undocumented, and had a child here, and their child had a child, automatically these people were no longer citizens of the United States. So this is the crux of it. And our protest was so strong that this issue was forced into the debate itself, where both of them actually claimed ownership of this law. So we're saying, if this is the immigration policy of these two candidates, it's important that people in the United States understand it and know what it is when they go to vote.
Let's make it clear to our listeners that State Senator Espaillat is of Dominican descent, campaigns vigorously in the Dominican Republic, and has said on several occasions that it's the Dominicans' turn to represent Harlem in Congress, and that Congressman Rangel has a home in the Dominican Republic and goes there quite often.
He had a home which, in the midst of scandals, he was forced to sell, as we understand, because of money that he was making on this home that he had not claimed in his documents. And he was censured in the Congress, and that's how he lost the chairmanship of the Ways and Means Committee in the U.S. Congress.
Is this pandering to the Dominican vote on Rangel's part, and does this further poison relations between the communities?
Well, definitely pandering, but what we were saying yesterday is that because Rangel has attacked Espaillat on the basis of Espaillat's Dominican origin, and he said that Espaillat's only claim to fame here is his Dominican origin, and because there is a large Dominican presence in the 13th Congressional District. So there's been a lot of talk in the press about racism on the part of Rangel and discrimination against Espaillat's ethnicity. But what we had said yesterday is that the real issue of racism in this race is both of these leading candidates' support for an apartheid policy against Haitians and Dominicans of Haitian descent living in the Dominican Republic.
Many Dominicans, despite the fact that most are descendants of slaves themselves, seem to define their nationality in opposition to Black Haiti.
The elephant in the room in all of this is that Haiti is a Black country. Haiti is the first Black republic here on this side. Rose up, as you know, in 1804, defeated the slave powers, and created a safe haven for Blacks from anywhere who would reach our shores. In our first constitution, this is what Jean-Jacques Dessalines stated, that any Black person or a Native American who would step foot on our shores would be automatically a free man, free person. And we would put our army, our country on the line to defend that individual's freedom. So Haiti is a Black country, proudly Black country. 99.9% of us, I should say, because there are some Haitian clowns, you know. But the Dominican Republic on the other side, which got its independence from Haiti in 1843, is, despite the obvious skin color of Dominicans, a very, very large percentage of Dominicans, they prefer to be white. And in their national registry process, their ID cards, the Black designation is reserved only, I tell you, for Dominicans of Haitian descent. Any other Dominican, however dark they might be, they will have them as Indios, they will have them as all of these other ridiculous categories, but Black. So this is the matter, is that Dominicans feel that Haitians are coming to soil their country, that they are a white country, and this was the policy of Rafael Trujillo, of Balaguer, leaders of the Dominican Republic for many years, who feel that they need to cleanse their country. And this is the language that they use, cleanse their country, because Haitians are Black and they are coming to dirty, to make them more Black. And Trujillo, who has Haitian parentage, when he died, he was killed, and they found next to him a powder container with white powder. So all the time he would powder his face to make him appear more white. And this is the issue here. It's an issue of economics, because of the isolation, because of the punishment that Haiti has been receiving since 1804 for daring to bring an end to this institution of slavery, to initiate the end of this institution of slavery. The colonial, the slave powers, they collectively conspired to punish Haiti. And as a result of this punishment, Haiti has been impoverished beyond measure. And because of this, Haitians look for life all over the place. And the closest place that Haitians can get some relief is in the Dominican Republic, where they can basically walk across the border. It's a lot of mistreatment historically, and I have to tell you that the mass migration started during the U.S. occupation of both parts of the island, when the U.S. set up these sugar companies, industry in the Dominican Republic, and they actually brought the Haitian labor over to work in the cane fields.
And so by endorsing what you call this apartheid law, Congressman Rangel and State Senator Espaillat are endorsing a sick kind of racial relationship that exists in the Dominican Republic, endorsing it here in the United States.
Absolutely. And we have to say also that the fact that in Haiti today you have a puppet government imposed on the population by the United States to do its bidding, you have no real voice of protest from the Haitian government. And I have to tell you, the strongest voice against this September 23rd ruling has been coming from CARICOM. It's been coming from Prime Minister Gonzalez, who, as the current leader of CARICOM, has basically said that so long as this policy stands, the Dominican Republic, who had an observer status in CARICOM and was vying for membership, would not become a member.
And yet, even with this law, these Dominican businessmen will continue to import Haitians and then mistreat them once they are there.
Absolutely. It's going on today. And there's an incident that your listeners can look up. And this happened last March in a place called Boca de Chacon in Dominican Republic, where the Dominican government was in the process of building government housing. And the government of the Dominican Republic brought in 400 Haitian construction workers. And after months of work, these people were not paid. And when they rose up, the Dominican army basically had a massacre and killed many of the Haitian workers. And those who were lucky to remain alive basically had to run across the border to Haiti. So this is the problem here, because we know we're living in the United States. We know that racism is alive and well in the United States. But here in the Dominican Republic, it is blatant state policy, the apartheid, the racism. And so this is why we are calling on people living in the 13th Congressional District not to vote for either of these supporters of apartheid, which are Congressman Rangel and State Senator Espaillat. And we are calling on people of conscience around the world to boycott tourism in the Dominican Republic, to boycott Dominican products and services until the state policy of apartheid, not the September 23rd ruling, which just happened last year, but the state policy of apartheid that Haitians and Dominicans of Haitian descent are subject to every day of their lives, is no longer.
Haitian community activist Dahoud André in New York.
The Black is Back Coalition will hold its international annual conference in Philadelphia, August 16th through the 17th. Black is Back Chairman Omali Yeshitela appeared recently on Black Agenda Television. He said President Obama has been worse for black people than George Bush.
He's been worse because, first of all, Bush couldn't have got away with the things that he did without some kind of response, not only from the black community. The thing is not just that a lot of black people did not come out, have not been involved in struggle in part because of Obama. The thing is that he's neutralized so many forces, taken them out of action. With Bush, people knew who he was. Our community knew who he was. I mean, he even had entertainers like Kanye West. Bush doesn't like black people. But that was not understood about Obama. It wasn't understood that part of what Obama's function was to act as a cover for white power and for imperialism. So he's escalated war. Not only has he escalated war, he's had his hands personally involved, and he's the one who signed off on assassinations and things. In fact, many of the assassinations we've seen with drones has required Obama's signature to do it. Obama was the guy who gave the order to shoot the 17-year-old kid who was supposed to be a pirate, if you remember, from the Somalia incident. So he's escalated war. He's done it with a neutralized African community who would not come out, and not just the broad sector of the African population. We're talking about people who call themselves nationalists and communists who were in Obama's pocket, who united with imperialism because Obama was the president. And that's the thing that I think really needs to be made clear. It's not just that they liked Obama and supported Obama. They were supporters of imperialism precisely because Obama was the one who was at the helm.
Now, almost as if they were repudiating their own
Repudiating, yes. And, of course, in, you know, under the Obama presidency, we've seen assaults on the rights and traditions of Africans that no white president could have done, would have done. They'll do it now because Obama has said it's all right to do it. But Obama, if you remember, even in the first so-called presidential debate that they had in Harlem, New York, the question was asked of Obama, of all of them, whether or not they would support reparations. And at this time, reparations was one of the driving questions that was seemingly involved in bringing the disparate sectors of the black community together. And Obama came out opposed to reparations. He said he didn't feel that it was right to unite with folk around traditional prejudices or contradictions. I forgot how he characterized it, but it didn't seem to go for Jews, because almost as soon as he got off the platform, he was on his belly in Miami, right, to reactionary Zionist pigs, promising them something that no white president has ever been able to say. He's given them Jerusalem as the, you know, in Israel and things like that.
Which was in contravention of past U.S. policy.
It was. So this guy has gone places that that Bush couldn't have done without contradiction. Then he neutralized many of the white people, not just white leftists, but even the white people who love us, in quotes, you know, who always ready to do something, would give, because they did theirs when they voted for Obama. I've done my part. I voted for Obama, kind of thing. So it was a really interesting and difficult period for a moment for some people. But I didn't see it as being extraordinarily difficult. I knew that Obama would confuse, was confusing, and to some extent is confusing today. But I also understood, as Nkrumah stated, that neocolonialism, a white power in black face, is the last stage of this thing. And you know, where can they go after this? What more can they do after this? And what we see now happening in the United States with Obama is something, as we know, that has happened throughout the world. I mean, Batista was neocolonialism, and then Fidel and Fidelismo got rid of him. Somoza was neocolonialism, and then the Sandinistas, and you know, all over Africa, we've seen neocolonialism, and we are trapped with neocolonialism today, now. And I think Obama is good not just for Africans in this country, but I think around the world, because there were many Africans on the continent who, recognizing the power of the U.S. to interfere in their lives and to wreak havoc and thing, now seeing this black man there saying, wow, with this power, look at what he's going to do for black people. And of course, that wasn't the case. And I think it's going to prove to have been a fundamentally important lesson for all of us. It's like Wilson Good many, many times over.
In Philadelphia,
right.
You seem to be saying that the spell has been broken.
The spell has been broken. And even at the height of this intoxication with Obama, most Africans, and you remember, you've talked often about the polls that showed that notwithstanding the fact that our community suffered most economically, on the one hand, on the other hand, the polls showed that ours was the most expectant in terms of positive things that would come.
Optimistic.
I think that most Africans said they were for Obama because they were supposed to be for Obama. Do you know what I mean? I mean, it's like, this is what, it's like, you know, like somebody talking about your mama, and it doesn't matter that she ties you up at night and you know, beats you with an extension cord, that's your mama. So everybody knows you're supposed to say nice things about your mama, and that's with Obama, because people have experienced those policies in real life in our communities all around this country. And I think that at the point where people got over the illusion that he's doing because the white folks are making him do it, or he's going to, once he's there, he's been elected, he's going to now show what he really stands for, I think all of that is gone. And I think that people can hear, and increasingly people are stepping forward. If you go like on social media now, the kind of stuff you see about Obama, you couldn't have seen that just a couple of years ago. So I think the spell has been broken, and I'm glad the spell has been broken. I have a visceral response to Obama, to be frank with you, because so many African people have gone into the trenches, many of whom assuming that the only way we can make progress is in the electoral arena anyway. Many of them growing up wanting to be able to say, I can be the president anyway. And then for this character to come there, and what he's done is played on the emotions of our people, He's played the African community, not a single promise that he made to this constituency, his most loyal constituency. He has made not a single promise, said and done nothing. And the only thing he's done is criticize in the most callous, reactionary kinds of way. And even when he wasn't criticizing us directly, even sometimes when he referred to himself, he played into the worst, most callous, reactionary assumptions that even Klan people, remember he called himself some kind of mongrel or something to that effect, you know?
Kind of
mutt. Mutt, yeah, and that kind of thing. So Obama has been a horrible lesson, I think, for our community, and I think we've come out of here much stronger than what we went into it with.
Well, let's talk about some even more fundamental aspects of politics. In black politics and American politics in general, seems to have degenerated to the point that people think that all of politics is electoral politics.
Yeah, and that was one of the things that you found interesting too, is that some people who we've respected over long periods of time, those of us who've been involved in the movement, who would raise the question when you criticize Obama, they would say something like, well, what do you want, McCain? Or do you want...
As if that's the only alternative.
Yeah, exactly. Or Hillary. And what are you, if not Obama, then what are you going to do? And some of these people are old enough to know better, in the sense that there have been times in our struggle, in relatively recent history, when we had genuine revolutionary movements, where at the time, the height of the Black Panther Party, the black, nobody said, if you don't vote for Nixon or Johnson, or what are you going to do? I mean, what it's clear you're going to do is you're going to build movement to take the political space, the revolutionary space, the democratic space that we need. You recognize that the system won't give it to you, and especially won't give it to you if you're black. If you're Mexican, you know, et cetera. So that's extraordinary. So what has been defined as politics in the recent period is something that locks us in to the imperial space. And even when Jesse Jackson, I remember when Jesse Jackson, 1980s, he ran for office, and he ran for president. And we criticized and challenged that because it was clear, and this is what you see at the height of certain kinds of crisis. Now, at the moment where Africans and other people would begin to look for alternatives to the Democrats, which is where our loyalty has been for the longest period of time,
then there's this Negro who would step forward to lead us back safely into
the embrace of the system through the Democratic Party. Jackson did that. And we exposed Jackson and why he was doing it. I mean, this is the guy who would do this, and then he would go to Alabama and he'd take pictures with George Wallace, you know, to show that he's a regular guy. You know, he wants to make sure that he's working against the assumption of the Democratic Party, you know, being the party of just black people. He's for everybody, you know, and so he shakes hands with Wallace. And so we're exposing this, and then they said, well, you must be working for the CIA because you made a poster with Jesse Jackson shaking hands with George Wallace. Well, if we're the CIA because we posted the picture, then who the hell is Jackson, you know, who was shaking his hand? And so people thought they could build a movement off the tails, the coattails of Jesse Jackson. Of course, Jesse Jackson, history has proved, didn't have very, very long coattails.
That was Somali Yeshin Taylor, chairman of the Black is Back Coalition.
Russia and China are moving towards a deeper economic and political alliance, fueled by the aggressive posture and actions of the United States. Washington's hostility is pushing the two huge Eurasian powers closer, especially in the wake of America's threats against Russia over Ukraine. For more insights, we spoke with Eric Dreitzer, an independent policy analyst who runs the website StopImperialism.org.
The fact of the matter is that the conflict in Ukraine, which was, of course, precipitated by a coup that was supported and financed by the United States and the West, the conflict in Ukraine has really led to a souring of relations between the United States and Russia, relations which had been tense and cold for previous years, but which have really escalated in recent months. And it is these tensions that have led to the, what I would call, absolutely absurd move by the Obama administration and by its European lackeys to sanction Russia and to attempt to isolate it economically, whatever exactly that means. And of course, with Russia being such a vital part of Europe's economic future by providing upwards of 30% of Europe's natural gas, This is a tectonic shift in geopolitics. And so Russia, as a countermeasure, has looked eastward. Of course, the landmark deal that was signed between Russia and China a few weeks ago regarding gas for the next 30 years is a major development. But we also have seen the establishment of the Eurasian Economic Union, which is a union between Russia, Kazakhstan, and Belarus that would essentially create a free trade zone of economic integration between the three countries. Now, the reason, of course, why this is so important geopolitically is because the Eurasian Economic Union, under the auspices and leadership, of course, of Russia and President Putin, becomes a vital linchpin in a much larger geopolitical and economic strategy that is being executed by China. Many people have heard of this thing called the New Silk Road, as China is developing economically and looking to establish economic ties, direct economic ties over land with the European market. They're looking towards establishing this New Silk Road stretching from China all the way through Turkey and into Europe. Of course, the Eurasian Economic Union is smack dab in the center of all of this, and this is really the new trend for the 21st century in terms of geopolitics and in terms of alliances.
This sounds very much like the United States accelerating the processes of its own decline. It attempts to isolate Russia, but succeeds only in pushing Russia, the greatest exporter of energy in the world, closer to China, soon to be, and maybe already, the greatest economic power in the world.
That's exactly right, and it would seem a self-defeating policy from Washington and from Brussels, and yet they continue with this strategy. Now, there are some who would say this is merely blundering. There are, of course, neocons in the political establishment who say this is Obama's weakness. There are many who are positing a number of ideas about what it is the United States can and should do, but the reality is that the United States doesn't have control anymore. The United States does not have a compliant Russia on its knees as it did in the 1990s. The United States cannot simply bring countries into NATO and into its orbit the way it did with the Baltic states in the 90s and Poland in the early 2000s, the way that it has done with Georgia and with Kosovo. Ukraine has presented, to use Obama's discredited terminology, a red line for Russia. And that red line, once the United States crossed it by creating a civil war in Ukraine, has pushed Russia to the east, has pushed Russia into an alliance with China, an alliance that many have said for many years was coming, but that really needed a sort of an impetus, an opening stimulus that would sort of allow for this relationship to blossom. And, well, quite frankly, Obama and his blundering foreign policy have really provided that impetus.
And possibly done the world a favor in that regard.
Absolutely right. If you see Russia and China developing together economically, it's not a stretch to see Russia and China moving towards security and military cooperation. In fact, we've seen that over recent years with the establishment of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Of course, from the economic side, you have the BRICS, but the Shanghai Cooperation Organization is a very important regional grouping dominated by Russia and China that is moving more into the security, counterterrorism, military cooperation sphere. And then if you consider, of course, the United States and the West's provocative actions in Eastern Europe and couple that with the United States and its partners' provocative actions in the South China Sea against China, you begin to see that Russia and China are viewing the way that world geopolitics is moving as being a confrontational sort of geopolitics and strategy. And so as a countermeasure, Russia and China move closer together. And this is absolutely critical because it is not simply economic and financial necessity that is pushing them together. There is also a political, strategic, and a military necessity. And in coming years, we're going to see that relationship blossoming on multiple fronts.
It should be noted that none of the BRIC nations endorsed the U.S. condemnation of Russia's position in the Ukraine.
That's right. And you see that the election results in India, which have brought a pro-business, right-wing, quasi-right-wing nationalist government led by Narendra Modi, which in many ways is a negative development globally. But of course, from the perspective of the geopolitics that we're talking about, in many ways it could be seen as positive because Modi and Russian President Putin are in many ways cut from a very similar cloth in terms of their conservative cultural and political outlook and their pro-business, pro-capitalist, or maybe we should say pro-state capitalist outlook financially and economically. And so likely the India-Russia relationship, which for decades has been in many ways the cornerstone of Russian foreign policy, that will continue to blossom. And then also, of course, as we've mentioned, China and Brazil, which is growing on the world stage economically. So the BRICS has a common goal, common economic development goals, and then from the political and the military side, as I've already mentioned. And so these countries see that the future is not solely with the United States and cozying up to Washington, that the future is a multipolar future. And that's what many of us have been arguing for and struggling for many years.
Meanwhile, the United States presents Europe with a "you are with us, the United States, or against us" kind of ultimatum, demanding that the Europeans limit their large volume of trade with Russia, even as the euro continues to be in crisis.
Exactly. And the United States is forcing the Europeans to act against their own interest. And this is what's so, I think, difficult, at least politically, for many people in Europe to swallow. The fact that because the European Union is a part of an imperial system with the United States as its head, because the European Union is part of that system, they really don't have any independent foreign policy. They really don't have any sovereignty either within the nations of Europe themselves, or really as a union of nations either, because at the end of the day, they work lockstep with U.S. foreign policy. And that's why a country like Germany has these deep internal contradictions with regard to their Russia policy. Politically, they seem to be towing the Washington line, viewing very vehement anti-Russian rhetoric, while on the other hand, Germany being the number one export economy in Europe, being the economic driver of Europe and being very, very significantly dependent upon Russia's gas exports. And that's not only via the Nord Stream pipeline, but through a number of other economic arrangements that they have. And so Germany is in many ways risking its own economic future by following this destructive path laid out by Washington and the Obama administration. And it's these internal contradictions in Europe that are really coming to the surface. And that's why you're seeing very prominent voices, former leaders, former politicians coming out against the policy of Berlin, against the policy of Brussels, and screaming from the mountaintops that this policy is absolutely crazy.
So more and more, the United States presents a challenge to the world. Either you can hold on to your national sovereignty, or you can become a subsidiary of U.S. foreign policy.
That's absolutely correct. And actually, it reminds us back to 2008 when many of us were saying that President Obama is going to be no different than a President Bush. And President Bush famously said, "You're either with us or you're with the terrorists." And Obama is essentially presenting a very similar dichotomy to much of Europe. You're either with us or you're against us. In other words, you're either with us or you're with Russia. And this is, of course, counterproductive. And this is really, I think, illustrative not only of the completely unrealistic and in many ways utterly distorted worldview that Obama and his administration share, but I think it's also indicative generally of a decline and a decay within political establishment and even within the ruling class of the United States. There is such a thing as imperial hubris, and I think that many of them are suffering from this kind of hubris in which they think that this, like in the 1990s, is a situation where the United States can simply dictate to the world how policies will go, how foreign policy should be enacted, and how global politics should develop. And it certainly is not the 1990s anymore. You have a resurgent Russia. You have a very strong China. You have an emerging India and Brazil and other centers of power in the world. And it seems that U.S. policymakers are the last to realize it.
Eric Dreitzer of StopImperialism.org in New York.
A princess of the theater and black progressive politics has passed. Mumia Abu-Jamal has this report for Prison Radio.
Her name was Ruby Dee, and though she has made her transition into the realm of the ancestors, she's available for all to see in all her beauty, dignity, charm, and poise for a long and distinguished career on stage, screen, and television. Despite such a long and legendary career as an actress, one would be hard-pressed to find a role where she portrayed anything less than the best of black people. Her best self shone, no matter the role, no matter the script. Like her late husband, the master actor, Ossie Davis, their work was a theater of black dignity, black family, and black love. Wadia Jamal loved them both. When I asked her why, she said, "I love how they love. They found ways to practice their chosen craft, but never sold their souls to the cameraman or the director." Ruby Dee was also a lifelong activist who supported Malcolm X, the Black Freedom Movement, and yes, yours truly. She was a published poet, and her 1999 book, My One Good Nerve, was funny, witty, and insightful. In her poem on black youth, The Mighty Gents, it was titled, she wrote, "Fulfillment dreams spawned by unintelligible economies, by the gangster class, by religious hymns and haws, by the respectable corrupt, by ineffectual classroom rituals, by sick and tired middle class, by daddies who didn't know, and by mamas who couldn't stop them. Dreams that guaranteed only early rigor mortis, clang spastically in heads, messed up too by lady fingers, cowboy flicks with gunslingers, taming frontiers, slaves, Indians, God, anything." That was one of the voices of Ruby Dee, the poet, the actress, the human rights and civil rights and freedom supporter and activist. Ruby Dee at 91.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. And while you're there, check out the latest episode of Black Agenda Television. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the black left. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Martin Nwoga.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.